listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up, Hollywood. This is your host of the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into this episode. We have an amazing director and cinematographer all the way from the San Gabriel Valley to my hometown, Mr. Alessandro Gentile. How are you, man?
I'm doing well. Doing well. Thanks for having me, Nikki.
You must have been very happy when Argentina won the World Cup, my friend.
I've been waiting since 86, man. So it's like, I remember watching it as a kid, you know, and that happened. It was epic. And then just was waiting for the next opportunity after that, you know?
You know what's crazy? I was recording a record with a friend of mine who's from Argentina. And he said, you know, he told me at the beginning of the World Cup, he said, there's somebody that has predicted the last three winners of the World Cup. And he predicted Argentina to win. And then they lost to Saudi Arabia the next week. And I was like, dude, it's not looking good, man. And he was like, Just wait, you know, it's a whole tournament, you know. Were you sweating during any of that? You must have been a little bit.
Oh, man, I was going nuts, man. I was going nuts. And what's crazy is my daughter had a soccer game that final.
And oh, so, wow.
I'm like at the stoplight, like on my phone, looking at the freaking, you know, the penalty kicks, dude. So I get back on the car, driving the thing, penalty kicks. And I was like, oh, man, it was crazy. Crazy.
You're like cheering at the wrong times because you're watching the wrong game.
Yeah, exactly. It's all delayed.
Well, you are a very talented director and cinematographer. We're going to talk a little bit about your backstory first. So you went to UCSB and studied film, right? That's a pretty notable film school. Tell me what drew you to, you know, when was the moment of Zen first that you wanted to become a filmmaker? Was it a movie that you saw? Was it something that you experienced? What was the moment of Zen that made you want to become a filmmaker?
Yeah, so I think the first time I like saw a Coen film, I think it was a Big Lebowski or one of those early films, Raising Arizona. And I was just like, whoa, man, these guys are just so extremely talented. And I felt like filmmaking was the art form to gravitate to because it encompasses all the art forms. You got photography, theater, music. Yep. And that was a premium, like, you know, art form. And so I just gravitated towards it. At the time, I was you're a tennis player as well. So I got a scholarship to play at Cal Poly SLO. And I was studying business there just because, you know, my dad's like, hey, you should do business, blah, 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 more options. And I just wasn't really into that. But I'm glad I did for a little bit. But then I gravitated towards Santa Barbara. And also, like, the tennis coach, I wasn't vibing too much. And so I transferred to UC Santa Barbara for tennis. And, of course, chose that because of the film program. And so I was just playing D1 tennis and freaking film, dude. I mean, come on. I'm watching
that's such a dichotomy too, because you're doing the two things you love and they're both competitive and they're both like, you always have to learn with both. You know what I mean?
Exactly. I'm like watching like Wong Kar Wai, like Scorsese, like all these, like Stanley Kubrick, all these great filmmakers, and playing tennis and just like, you know, just watching films all day and just writing about films. It was like the best experience. And they were so good to me, man. They were really, really supportive. They're still supportive now. I go and sometimes judge their student film festival.
That's awesome.
And participate. Yeah, so I still participate with them and super fun. And through that alumni experience, Santa Barbara Film Festival also kind of like, you know, very responsive with us, with me and my films, and very always interested in what I'm doing.
I saw Lodo, one of your films we're going to showcase, went up there for the Santa Barbara Film Festival, right?
Yeah. So that was the last piece. And they actually asked me about Luis Garza documentary, but we missed that window. We were already committed to Downtown LA Film Festival. But for next year, they asked me to show them Della, the new boxing film, the female boxing film I'm doing right now. in post. So yeah.
So when you were in school, what was the biggest thing you think you got from film school? Was it like learning about lenses, learning about shots, learning about filmmaking in the way of storytelling? What was the thing that drew you the most to it? And also what did you gravitate towards?
Yeah, definitely storytelling. Cause I had the option to actually study specific like countries of cinema and also like specific directors. So, you know, I chose like Hitchcock, Stanley Kubrick, Wong Kar-wai, Chinese cinema, Japanese cinema, Italian cinema, and just really immerse myself in just watching film and narrative from all the greats. You know, I mean, you have like Fellini and Antonioni and all these like big, you know, directors that, and I gravitated towards more of a realist style. So if you see like my films are very, there's a lot of handheld, it's very organic and I love that
about the way you shoot. Handheld is awesome. Yeah.
Yeah. But then I mix it with a little stability. So I have a little bit of stability in there, just depending on the mood of the characters. Right. So just, but all those things, I just started realizing that patterns is what drives narrative in a film. And so you could do like, you know, handheld and all of a sudden it's, you know, go stable or maybe not even move the camera. And right. It's just all these things are psychological things to give the audience, a concept of the story and what the actual main character is going through at the time.
And you also do a lot of your own editing. Is that correct?
Yeah. So things I shoot, I definitely will do editing on these. Well, now that I'm directing, I actually do like a director's cut and then I toss it over to an editor to like just finish up and kind of have a different perspective. Even though I'm sitting there with them in the editing bay, like, I still like want like another point of view because I just get married to all of it. I get so married to it and just like love it all. And it's hard for me to let go of some things, but it's good. Like when there's another voice and they kind of reason with you and kind of go through, hey, well, do you really need that? Or maybe we shave off a little time here because it's really not stalling out the narrative a little bit. And that stuff I really enjoy, you know? And one thing like with the tennis stuff, you know, I had to kind of like, talking about competitive, like I was so competitive, I had to kind of like erase a little bit of that competitiveness. And I talk about this with all my friends and my colleagues all the time, like, because I'm so competitive. I'm like, but filmmaking is not that. Filmmaking is like you're forming a team. You're kind of championing and kind of coaching a team to get them all hyped up.
It's a team sport.
But at the same time, you can't be all like, whoa, super ego and energetic and crazy, you know, because you're so competitive with yourself or whatever. Right. And so I learned to dial that back. And so when I founded the Highland Park Independent Film Festival in Northeast Los Angeles, that gave me the opportunity to kind of shape myself in communicating with more of a team aspect. And that really helped me with that. And so now when I direct, it's really cool to have everybody feel included because they all matter. All the positions matter.
Yes.
And they're all contributing to one piece.
Right.
Which is how good can we make that piece, you know, with the resources and the knowledge and everything that we have.
How do you figure out a way to cut out something that you love? That is one of the hardest things I do. Even when I track music, it's like, if I put something in, very rarely do I say, no, that needs to come out. It's like, man, it usually has a life in there. How do you find that? No, we need to take that out. How do you do that?
It's so hard, man. It's so hard. So that's why I need a second voice to actually go through that. This last year, I just established a new production company called Radio Mediate Productions with my producing partner, Heather Flores. We formed this production company to because we both kind of gravitated to like creating our own work and like, you know, championing our own work, you know? So like our producer stuff, she produces my stuff and we just kind of together just kind of form, you know, like tell our stories that we want to tell. But so we have each other's ear on that, you know, we're like, hey, you know, like maybe she's like, maybe it's, you know, we need to kind of refine that little B story or something just to kind of like make it flow a little better. And then I'll tell her, oh yeah, maybe, you know, in this documentary, you could do this and that. And it's really cool to have another outside voice, but it's really hard to let go of some stuff, but really like time and just always trying to focus on the A story. So like, what is that A story? Is it a coming of age? Is it, it depends on what that A story is. Is it a love story, whatever it is. And just lending itself to that answers your whole question. That answers your doubts. If you're always sticking with that. So if you start kind of diverting this direction and it's like, maybe it's like 3 minutes too long, it's kind of an easy choice to drop that because that story is not refined. It's not like actually told very clearly in the piece. So it's really easy, you know, but you got to find those little nuggets that you don't want to let go of, but you just have to pull them out and just go, hey, you know, or just experiment and see. You know, sometimes you pull it out and you're like, let me just watch it and see how it flows. And sometimes it does and sometimes it doesn't. It'll jolt you a little bit, but usually it'll answer itself as you, you know, make those big drastic decisions. And they're very big commitments. You know, you're like, I'm going to pull that out.
Like, well, especially with the short films, it's like you don't have a lot of time. Yeah, so it's like you're telling this really acute story and you're having like a certain, you know, amount of time to tell this story, but you don't want it to kind of drag, or you don't want it to kind of like not have the life that it needs to kind of tell this and sustain the story. So like with short form, do you feel like there's a more, even more of an urgency to take stuff out, or do you feel like you can let things breathe a little bit because you have only a certain amount of time?
It's really hard. I mean, really telling a story in such a short amount of time, it's so hard because you can't really like flesh out the characters. It's really hard to like kind of like really tell the story you want to tell. Right. And Lodo was very, very challenging, man. Very challenging. Also, this boxing film I'm doing now, very challenging. It's like, because you're putting the same amount of effort in feature, right, but you're doing it into a short film, and you're trying to tell a story really quickly so people aren't like, you know, falling asleep or just kind of like, you know, out of it or not understanding what's going on. But it's tough. It's tough doing shorts. But very rewarding. It's a good way to actually transition into maybe getting funding for that, you know, feature, right, of that short, right? The two that Della, the boxing one, and also the documentary, both of those were in talks of, you know, doing a feature with both of those. So, but yeah, it's just, it's a good foot in the door and just kind of, you know, a way to like practice narrative storytelling, because it's pretty much like a long commercial in a way.
Well, you know what, it didn't feel like a long commercial in the sense that it's like, okay, I'm not seeing something artistic. And that was one of the things I texted you when I watched both the shorts. I haven't seen Della yet, but I saw the teaser. But you shoot in such a charismatic way. It's got such character in how you shoot and make things look, that the visuals tell the story too. It's almost like you have two stories going on at once, which I love. It's like you have the text and then you have subtext that the camera is kind of telling you. So I love the way that you shoot in that way. Is that a style that you kind of choose to shoot in, or is it something that you kind of like gradually started seeing, this is my signature, this is what I do?
Yeah, it's kind of my signature, but at the same time, I'm also like, I come from cinematography background. So like when I'm directing, basically I like to separate myself and kind of get a director of photography to come in and shoot for me. But when we frame, I already know exactly what kind of frame I like and we talk it through, but it's like, it's very organic and intentional, you know, how it's done, because I don't like to make things feel so contrived or like so like forced. And also like sometimes classic film schools, like they're always like, you get the coverage. You don't always need coverage. Like sometimes you can just let the film, like, let the actual scene play out in the master. It's like, it's fine.
Right.
Because it's actually saying something to the audience. It's like, okay, we're taking the breath. And we're letting the space kind of run itself and let the actors kind of move in that space, which is fine. That's fine. You know, you don't have to always do the close-up over the shoulder, this and that. And that close-up has to be really intentional. Like, you can't just show any sort of close-up. You have to, like, actually be intentional about that close-up. So
I love the intro of Lodo, when you had the kid dribbling the soccer ball. I love that. He came from the side and just kind of started coming down the street and then just darted off. I was like, that was such a cool shot, and it was so simple, but it was just a way to tell the story and have a through line from when he's leaving the house to going to meet his friend, you know, to have this experience, you know. Tell me a little bit about, like, the story of Lodo. How did it become an inspirational part of, you know, your story?
Yeah. Well, first off, I want to give credit to Jeff Dolan. Jeff Dolan was my cinematographer on that piece. He shot McMillions, a documentary that you saw on HBO. We became really good friends through that film festival. And also just like, we shot listed the whole thing together like weeks before. And so we had a plan. It was like, this was the vision. There was some happy accidents that happened. We're like, okay, well, maybe we go off text and just kind of do something a little more organic and real, kind of like that shot you just talked about, which made sense. But the inspiration came from my aunt. My aunt wrote a short story with her son called El Alma del Lodo, the soul of the mud. And that sparked my imagination. I was like, this is a really interesting concept, a boy who gets haunted by the mud of a cemetery. Right. And I'm like, whoa, that's really interesting. But it was in short story form, one page. So of course I had to flesh out the dialogue and description and, you know, all that, you know, and create a script out of it. With my producing partner, Marita De La Torre at the time, we kind of fleshed out the script together and the story. And from there, it just kind of fell into place, but we kind of sat on it for a while. You know, I started a family, so all this, you know, got a little diverted this way. And then the film festival started and got really busy. And the funding wasn't coming. We're trying to find a way to do it. And we're thinking about filming it in Texas. And it was too expensive. And then so we made it feel like Texas.
Oh, wow. I shot it there. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, so we shot the B-roll shots, all the landscapes in Texas. Came back and found locations that looked and felt like Texas, like South Texas, like down by the border, Texas. So, and that's how we did that, you know. And that was
so. Where did you go to shoot, like Chula Vista? Where did you go to shoot it?
Yeah, so we shot the house was in Highland Park. We actually found a house, like a abuelita house, you know, from a friend of mine, April. She let us use her house and live there for a couple of days, which was really gracious of her. And her mom as well, and we shot all that there. And but it had that vibe. It had like that kind of Texas Mexican grandmother vibe, right?
That's cool.
And then we shot Salt and Sea, the dream sequence, and then also south of the Salt and Sea, a small town called Neyland. So all the street stuff was all there, and it felt like Texas. But we just had to avoid mountains in the distance, you know. So it was really hard. Because right. There's like mountain ranges in the distance, so we just had to kind of like just frame it a certain way and just that's avoid funny. All that.
I actually like, don't shoot the mountains.
Yeah, exactly. I re-erased a little bit in post, but not too much, but a little bit. And the cemetery was a beautiful old historic cemetery in San Bernardino that we found. And I was looking all over Southern California, everywhere, and landed on this place, and it's like actually like. It was a beautiful place, man. The tree was what.
The tree was amazing, dude. The tree was like a character in the film, dude. It was amazing.
And that was in my vision, and that was in the script, and it was just like, where do we find this? Where do I go to find this? And avoid mountains. And it's crazy because that tree covered the mountains. It was perfect, man. Yeah. If you look through, it's like you can't even see the mountains in the background, but it's like this beautiful tree, part of the character. And just this boy has this experience there that just changes the course of his life in that day. You know?
Well, you know what was cool? It was a very much like a Shawshank Redemption tree. That's what I liked about the tree. It was like, this tree is like beautiful. It's majestic. It has a character. Let's play the trailer real quick. Here's the trailer for Lodo. Cool.
Who are you?
You know, I knew your mother. Did you know that?
Pero, ¿estás seguro que estás bien?
En el nombre de Todopoderoso, reprendo todo espíritu negativo que habita en este lugar y los alrededores. Y los
esta tarde tuve un sueño muy raro. Soñé con tu mami.
That's awesome. You know, it's interesting. You kind of almost make it like a horror movie. Tell me how that must have been a little bit difficult just to like make it seem like that, but also pull away from that in the actual film. Tell me how you kind of approach the trailer and you approach the film in those two different ways.
Yeah, I was trying to create mystery with the piece. By showing a little bit of, you know, we don't know what that is, what entity that is that he's going to encounter. And, just gives some sort of a mystery quality to it. But yeah, it feels very horror film like. And I've also gotten like, you know, science fiction. You know, it has a little science sci-fi a little bit. The film itself. I mean, not the trailer, but when you start watching the film, you're like, it's a little bit of sci-fi, kind of supernatural. So
yeah,
it was like choices to kind of just keep you in the mystery, but also like kind of pull you in to come watch it. So that's you know.
Well, what's cool about it is it's got like a folky kind of like storytelling, like folklore vibe. Yeah. You know what I mean? And I love the casting you did. Like, the kid is amazing. The grandma's amazing. The mom is amazing. How did you figure out, what was the audition process for you? Just like looking through headshots? Did you have in-person auditions? How did you go about it?
Yeah. So, again, my producing partner, she played the mother, Marisa De La Torre.
Okay.
And then years ago, when we first started talking about the idea of the project, she had met Laura Pantoliano. She had just moved from New York. And Laura Pantoliano is on Hulu, This Fool, that show, okay, that series at Hulu. And she's very well-known actress. So we kind of qualified her early on, but it was like so much gap of time went by. So when we started kind of like, you know, hey, let's, you know, we're ready to go. And like, it took a minute to like, you know, talk to her and kind of get her like sold on it again and revisit it. But she came on board and she blew it out of the park, man. And then Daniel Mora, a great friend of mine, I met through the film festival. He's on The Bridge and a bunch of shows on Netflix and HBO. And he's a amazing friend, actor, and just collaborator, and just loves to just shoot and just be part of the process and collaborate. And he was also just graciously came on. I just talked to him. He was like, yeah, totally, man. I'm down, you know, for you. Yes. And so he came along and then we had a standstill there. We're like, who's going to be our kid? You know, we auditioned all these kids and they were like, they're like these Nickelodeon kids, you know, that don't speak Spanish well. And they're like, some of them were Filipino. Some of them were like, they're trying to speak Spanish. I'm like, dude, like, you know, it's just not working, you know? And they're too polished and clean, you know?
Right.
And so we went to Joseph Sanchez at Operation Street Kids. He actually mentors kids in East Los Angeles. And he's like, hey, why don't you try this kid, Jaden Amorado? You know, he's like, he was on a Nickelodeon show, but wants to get into acting, but still kind of doesn't have that much experience, but would like to, you know, kind of build this stuff up. And there you go. We auditioned him. Wow. And he just kind of like, I was like, whoa. He like read with his brother. And then I kind of had him read another like scene. And then we just made up lines too. And his dad was working at USC at the time in the theater department. And so it was kind of like coaching him on the side. And so he just came on, man, and really just, wow, just blew us all away. The first day, I mean, the only challenge we had when he first came on set was like trying to prevent him from like getting his eyeballs on the lens, you know?
Yeah.
It's just like, he kept wanting to look at the lens. And there's a couple moments, if you see a fraction of a second, you can see it in the shot. I can see it. You probably won't see it, but like,
no, yeah,
like,
I didn't notice it.
It's there,
yeah,
forever, right. But other than that, it was just like amazing, amazing. He sunk in, he cried on cue, no drops, nothing. It was straight up. His emotions were straight up, dude. And like his dad was like, hey, yeah, just think of that uncle, you know, you lost and you were so close to, blah, blah, blah. And just, harness that and just, you know, let it kind of go. And he kind of zoned out and just, so we had to like sometimes just kind of shoot and just like, just, the camera guy would just get in position and we're just kind of just let it go, let it breathe, let him do his thing. And it worked out, especially at the very end, man. He's like, that was very intense, very intense.
And I love when he kicks the soccer ball. You think it just kind of like went over the fence, man. That thing was like, he kicked it so far, dude. It was like, I was like, this kid's still going to get the ball. I'm like, that guy needs to get a soccer endorsement right away.
I kicked the soccer ball. I'm guilty. I kicked the soccer ball.
It was awesome.
I had to justify like how to get it so far into the cemetery, you know, because when he walks in, it's just like there's a big distance. You're like, dude, he has a trek over there to get in there. So how do I justify that? And so it was one of those things. And again, that's like, you know, we're trying to avoid like city and like, you know, homeless people and things. So I'm like, I told the camera guy, dude, you gotta shoot up, you know, like straight up, like low angle up. You can't see all no streets, no nothing. He's all, so what do you want me to do, man? Just stand here? Like, it was a running joke. We're just like, dude, what do you want me to do? I can't, like, move. Like, what am I going to do? Just shoot up their nose?
Just shoot up.
just shoot up, dude. You know, palm
tree. No, but
again,
it looks like the total consistency. Like it was just funny when he picked up the ball. I was like, that kid's got a leg. Somebody give that kid a soccer endorsement right now. And I love that you tapped into your Argentinian roots. You're like, I'm going to kick this ball so far, man. Messi style, dude. Yeah, no, it was great. I really loved the film. I love the way it was shot. Casting was great. It has a really cool look too. It's got like a mystical, it's got like a dark energy, but it also has like a mystical magic to it. So it's really, really a cool project. So I really loved it. Let's talk a little bit about the documentary that you just shot too. So when you shot this, did you kind of shoot both these projects around the same time, or were you kind of like doing them sporadically whenever you had windows?
No, so Lodo kind of reached its final film festival last year. So so it kind of finished its cycle around, I want to say, the fall last year or so. And I was approached by Melissa Richardson Banks through my producing partner, Heather Flores. And she was like, hey, you know, I'm like, I'm representing and working with this a Chicano photographer who, you know, he was an activist documented a lot in the 60s and 70s, you know, bi-coastal, like here in Los Angeles and also in New York. And he's from New York. He's actually a Chicano from New York, right? You know, and so it's kind of a joke. And so he was having an art opening with his first time, like a really all his pieces, you know, it was all curated. By Armando Duran was the first one to like dive into his archives, like thousands and thousands of images just archived, you know, and just dove in there and started formulating a story, right, with all these images. And it was at the Riverside Art Museum next to Cheech's Museum over there in Riverside.
Oh, that's cool.
And so Melissa represents Cheech and, like, you know, works with him, and so that was the tie-in with all that as well. And and so I went over there, met with Luis, and we just bonded. We connected right away. We're just like, whoa, you know, and just had dinner, like no talks about anything. We just like just hung out. And we realized that like that was the best approach now moving forward with all our documentaries, which we've been doing since then, is just hanging out. Like just hang out for a little bit, just get to know them, right, and like really like talk. Don't talk about project, just get to know them and really sink into the vibe. And that's what happened. That's why it looks so organic and real and very observational, because we're just he's very comfortable, and we're just observing his life and going along the ride. And the ride of this is really to get his work into an institution to like live forever, right? His archives.
Right.
So whether it be the Smithsonian or wherever it ends up, right?
His pictures are amazing. His pictures were, I mean, the picture of Cesar Chavez. I mean, it was just really amazing stuff. It was kind of shocking that I think it was Life magazine like sent him the negatives back. Did he ever say why that happened? I mean, there must have been some prejudice or something going on. It just doesn't make sense why they wouldn't want to cover one of the biggest like movements in Los Angeles. It's crazy.
Yeah, I never asked. I never dug into the story with that, you know, because again, we're limited on time. But you know, there's all these like notes I have. But yeah, that's really a good point. I really never discussed that with him to see like why that just kind of didn't turn around.
Yeah, it was super whack.
Very iconic images too, and they're like, maybe they dropped the story. I have no idea, but like but that you know, just to be able to do that. So he's like kind of like the Chicano Forrest Gump, right? He's always at the right place at the right time. Wow. He also worked on Zoot Suit when it kind of started launching, right? He did the whole he produced the theater play for years, and then it went on to become a film, right? And so he's just and then Alfaro Siqueiros, David Alfaro Siqueiros, he's like the Mexican muralist.
Right.
He's the first one to come to L.A., create a controversial mural, and from there sparked a mural graffiti art movement in Los Angeles. This was like back in like the 40s, man. Like he just like it exploded from there, because like even though it was all whitewashed and like covered up, like there was like street artists kind of like sneaking into this building, kind of checking out, you know, breaking in through a window, checking out the piece and trying to see if it was still there, and breaking up, flaking off some of the paint, and just with their imagination, like, you know, just opened up this whole art scene, street art scene in Los Angeles. And that's why it's like we have so many murals, so much art on the streets of Los Angeles. And we're kind of like the, you know,
that's crazy. I didn't know any of this.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
cool.
And that's how that inspired that. And so he was part of that. He met him at the World Peace Conference. He just found himself at the World Peace Conference by chance and just had this conversation, this 2 days. Amazing experience with this man. He's like, you know, who's he? Because he just stands up. He's from Mexico. He's representing Mexico. And then he goes, who's the Chicano in the group here? And then he raises his hand, or they just started sparking a conversation and had this beautiful, just an entire day drinking, vodka and just talking about art and photography and politics. And it was, it really impacted him. So when he came back, DeVito Fawcett, he was pretty old at that time. I'm not sure how old he was at the moment, but he kind of wanted to like try to restore his mural and took it on for like 10 years,
wow.
got some really important people involved to actually start restoring the piece. And so they 10 years, man, 10 years. So like Dave Tarjay from California Locos got involved, and like a lot of these like local people just came together and like helped like restore the piece's original,
I love the picture that he got of him too. He did like an imitation of the self portrait that he painted, and he did like he captured such a cool image. I'm like, man, this guy's like picture taking is just like his photography. It speaks volumes, you know. And he is at the right moment at the right time, but it's like, you can tell he's shooting on. I assume he's shooting all of this on film because it's the 70s. Yeah, and it's just like the crazy thing about that is like you don't know what you get until you develop it, and yet he gets these striking images that it's just so crazy. So he really was like an accidental photographer in a lot of ways, but yet he was capturing all the coolest things and movements, cultural movements, exactly. And doing it through the Chicano lens, which was also amazing,
right.
Just like making us like a document. He was like a documentarian with photography, you know.
Exactly. And there's like just mountains and mountains of negatives, man. Like I haven't even like seen all this stuff, and I can't wait to like check it really all out. But like even his horizon, I always commented on his horizon. I'm like, dude, your horizon is straight on. That's not edited. You know, it's like his horizon is straight. And so those lines are straight. He's just storytelling. And he's such an inspiration to like the Chicano scene, and just Los Angeles in general.
Yeah.
He documented, so many things. And that's why like the story really needs to break out. And right now we're in the process of fundraising for the feature film, and which I think we're going to start shooting in spring.
That's
and
awesome.
And start really fleshing out more of the story. So now it's like really being able to dig in and really tell all the stuff, you know, when he was at war, like Bay of Pigs, he was at Bay of Pigs, like all this, like all these, again, all these crazy like moments in life, and he's like right there, like Angela Davis, March, like just all these things.
So wild. He was like right there at all these like iconic cultural movements,
exactly.
And the pictures that like I it's amazing that he got the access that he did, because that I don't know if it was necessarily always welcomed with some of these. Like I don't know, there's not a lot of pictures of Cesar Chavez like he got, which is really kind of amazing.
Yeah, very personal, very intimate
shots of him, which was one of the most striking parts of when I was watching the movie. I was like, man, this is amazing. You just don't see these kind of images, like this close. You see images of him, speaking, and they're kind of far away, or they're really stoic pictures, but he got like up close and personal. So did he ever tell you any like crazy moment that he had with Cesar Chavez, or any like moment of wisdom that he got from anybody? Alessandro, you there?
Oh, sorry, you cut out.
Oh, sorry.
You cut out the last
thing. Did you get any like moment of wisdom? Did he tell you about any moment of wisdom that he got from Cesar Chavez or Angela Davis or anybody? I think I don't know if I'm freezing or you're freezing. Are you freezing, Alessandro? Well, you know what? Let's play the trailer. We're gonna play the trailer right now. Let's play the trailer. We'll come back.
All right, cool.
Here's the trailer.
Thanks, brother.
I picked up a camera out of sheer desire to pick up a camera. It was not intended. I had no arts training. I had no photographic training. And my camera becomes that pen, that sword, that weapon, that ability to make sense of the world that surrounds me. As you approach and you see a subject, you instinctively raise your camera, and in that nanosecond exchange with that person. So it's a spiritual exchange that I feel. And it's a wonderful exchange because it is that moment of absolute connectivity.
So killing. Awesome. So what I was saying was, did he tell you any moments that he got some wisdom from Cesar Chavez or Angela Davis, any kind of like moments of Zen that he shared with them?
Yeah. So I think the main thing was he told me the other day, it was funny. We were having a conversation, having lunch the other day. He said, I actually wrote it here. Let me actually pull this up because it's really, really cool. Like, let me just pull this up because it really kind of impacted me and I had to write it down. Like, whoa, that's super cool. That, let's see, what was it here? So like, you know, he said like, we are at the right place at the right time. So this is like, whatever you experience, like you're actually like, you're supposed to be there. You're supposed to be there. That's supposed to happen. So wow. All these moments that he had and shared, right? It's such a simple thing, right? It's like, yeah, we're all like overthinking things and trying to like, what do I need to do next? And like stressing about stuff and going here and going there and creating this. But it's like, whatever that is, wherever you are, that's where you're supposed to be. And that's what's supposed to happen. So it's it was pretty powerful. I was like, whoa. And so, like, you know, we're having lunch, like Tyler and I were like, just sitting there, like having lunch with him. It's like, whoa, that's... It's so simple, but just said, right. It's so impactful. And
well, he seems to be like he doesn't question where he is at a certain time and place. That's why he's in the right place at the right time, you know?
But it's funny because he did for a long time. You know, he's like an artist like us, right? You just like, you know, we struggle to. We have our mental stuff and we're trying to get by, you know, make a living and doing what we love. But there came that time where he just sort of, you know, started reflecting and kind of, you know, growing and everything just started falling into place. I think he just kind of released himself from just that pressure of that and just started enjoying life and enjoying the people that wanted to help him, enjoying the collaboration, enjoying he's 81, dude. And he's just like, the guy is like, dude, he's like so like young at heart and just amazing and such a wealth of knowledge. We'll sit there and talk for hours and have like pan dulce and coffee, like for hours, man, like hours. And he's such a wealth of knowledge. And I'm so grateful to have crossed paths with him and to cross paths with Melissa Richardson Banks and, of course, my producing partner, Heather Flores. And just that was all just it all happened, you know, really quickly. And it just worked. It worked. And we're still, you know, fleshing this thing out.
I love that you're profiling like a Chicano photographer and a movement that is, I mean, it's a colorful time he's documenting, too, yeah. You know, through his lens. And you're also doing it through your lens and your perspective for some of the things that you've been able to benefit from the work of our generations before us. So I love that you're taking that stance. Was that intentional? Was it intentional to make Lodo about, you know, an all Hispanic cast and then to make this profile about the Chicano artist, photographer? Is that very intentional? You want to have that lens and kind of put that out there? Because I love that, by the way. It's awesome.
Yeah, well, I mean, I'm a Chicano. So I'm a Chicano. I'm born here. My mom's from Mexico, from Guadalajara. My dad's from originally born in Italy, raised in Argentina. He's Argentine. And just, you know, they met here in Los Angeles. I was born here in East LA. Actually, no, in downtown Los Angeles. And you know, I just, it was in my heart since I was a kid. You know, I speak both languages fluently. I actually learned Spanish first. Then you kind of had to do a little ESL in first grade just to kind of separate stuff. But then after that, just kind of everything flowed and it was perfect. And, but it was, it's just something that's in my heart and in my blood. And these stories need to be told, you know, and like our production company, Radio Media Productions, that's, you know, we're focused on Latino driven projects, you know, but also leaving it open, right? We leave it open to other stories, but there's always a Latino element to it. And I think it's really important because the stories are very unique and need to be told. And Chicanos and Latinos in Los Angeles and throughout the world need to, you know, have their voice. The voice needs to be heard. And things are starting to rattle a little bit. They're starting to rattle, you know, like LA, Hollywood, it's all starting to rattle a little bit with that. But it's true. It's like that. There needs to be a voice, outreach for Latinos. Well,
and the other thing too, it has to be, there has to be truth serum when it's right. The voice is coming from the community. That to me is huge because there are enough films made by people outside of the communities focusing on the communities, and that's not the same voice. And you know what I'm talking about because that lens can only be really eloquated and expressed, I should say, in a way that is honest and true. If you know the culture, grew up in the culture, know what's missing in the Hollywood culture and, you know, America in general. So I love that you're taking that approach. What were some of the obstacles that you faced with both this project and Lodo?
So this project, the main thing, that we came across, like that was really tough, was just trying to really follow Luis and try to, like, you know, kind of schedule with him to actually be able to do this, you know, be able to flesh it out. You know, his schedule is really tough. He's always, you know, just, you know, doing like gallery openings and all this stuff and just trying to like navigate through that. But for the most part, it was very seamless, very easy. You know, we didn't really, I think that the hardest part was editing because I sat there in the office, you know, we have an office here downtown LA. And I remember it was grueling because I was sitting there with a just gigantic, like, you know, almost 2 hour interview. And actually the original Chouinard house in South Pasadena where it was Dave Tarjay's home from California Locos. His, that's where the actual CalArts started. CalArts started at this place.
Oh, wow.
Right?
I didn't know that.
Yeah. So then it broke off from there. And then, you know, Disney got involved and they created something. And then now it's in Valencia. But that's sort of where it started. You know, all these, you know, amazing, like, painters, you know, in Los Angeles came out of there. Anyways, that's the backstory to the location where we filmed. But it was just to try to tell what I told in, like, less than 15 minutes was so grueling. I was just kind of pacing, like, laying on the ground, listening, making notes, highlighting transcripts, listening. It was just like days. It was like literally like a week and a half grueling time until I started narrowing down, like, okay, well, let's just focus on these specific things. They're super important and just follow that thread. But the main thing was always trying to stick with that A story, which was him trying to navigate and find a home for all his archive. And that's going to continue with the feature as well. We're going to go back to New York and film him in New York and his elements. And you know, maybe go to the Getty and like some of these places and try to, like, you know, see what's going on with that and try to find a resting place for his work.
Well, what's really cool too is you had this profile of him that was super honest. Did he have any influence over, like, I really want this part of the story to be told, or was he just like, document it the way you see it and, you know, let's just see where it comes, you know?
Yeah, he did it like a true artist, man. He knows how that is, you know, like he didn't micromanage anything. He just kind of like, you know, we were there and we just kind of like sort of set up ish a scene and then he would just do his thing. He was just an amazing actor, man. He was just like literally in the moment and I'm just capturing shots and stuff, but he's just like kind of in it. And so I'm just documenting. And some of those things, like in his home, I had to like really, like I had to do that alone. and just keep it very intimate and private. And right. We were able to capture a very real, organic experience. Just I think because it was the two of us, he wasn't distracted, and we were kind of in it together. And he was explaining things to me, and I'm learning, and I'm shooting, and it was just very beautiful. Like, we spent hours doing that. It was really cool. And but he gave me my space. He wasn't like micromanaging a little bit. It just little credits, that we had, the spelling and stuff, but because they were colleagues of his and friends. And other than that, it was all super smooth. And same with Melissa. Melissa also just kind of gave space and just
That's important.
Yeah. Because originally she actually wanted more of a marketing film, a marketing thing, a 2.5 minute marketing thing. And I just got filmmaker with it and just got a little crazy. And just so hopefully
no, it's tasteful. It's really tasteful, and it's I also when you capture him taking shots of people on the street. Was really cool because it was just candid. It was just him with a camera doing what he does, and then you see his story a little bit with those shots. Yes. Really cool.
And please, please buy his book. Look up on the website and buy his book, because he's very amazing. All his work in there. And then the music is by Raul Pacheco from Ozo Motley.
Yeah, so, it was awesome.
Ozo Motley,
they're so great.
Yeah. It was awesome. He came on board, and beautiful, man, beautiful stuff. So it was really lucky to have him.
So tell me, what were some of the obstacles with Lodo? What were some of the things that you hit with that?
Yeah, so Lodo, we ran into weather. We had to cancel. We had weather and COVID, man, because we shot during COVID. So right after that, so 2020. Kind of tail end of that whole stuff where it's starting to come back online, but we're just everyone's still freaked out and had to do testing and all that. And we were SAG, so we had to follow all those rules. And
wait, so did you do this? Because we did our shoot, we did One Night at the Village during the pandemic. Did you do it before or after that?
I think it was after that, yeah. So, yes, around that whole kind of pocket of time, right? Those 6 months, yeah.
That was a crazy time to do anything artistic, man. And you were right in the mix, making it happen. Yeah, that's awesome. Man.
Your piece is awesome, dude. I want to revisit that. That was cool.
Oh, man, it's so good. I show it to people all the time, and you did such a great job shooting that. But a lot of people don't realize how crazy it was. We had to put things on our shoes. Everybody was masked. It was, such a intimate thing, but, nobody was kind of, taking any chances. It's just a crazy, crazy thing.
Yeah, so I was lucky that on our clock, nobody got sick, so that was awesome. And then, but the kid got sick, and we had to postpone. Man. I think it was the stuff that we were shooting at south of Salton Sea, that whole little town. So we had to postpone that for a little bit. And but then that worked out. And then we ran into weather. We ran into some rain, so we had to postpone that. We were watching the weather every day with the cinematographer. Dude, I don't know. There's a window, but how it always shifts, usually a day or half a day. So we didn't take the risk, so we canceled. Then we had to reschedule 2 weeks after. That was the cemetery. We had to reschedule that, and then it just all kind of worked out. We got some nice fluffy clouds and all this stuff, and it all worked out. But those are the two challenging things, and trying to find the boy. It took a minute. Right. That was the boy was going to drive the whole thing, and luckily, again, we ran into Operation Street Kids, and then they referred the boy to us, and we went from there. Jaden and Omarado.
So from the start of shooting. Let's say you wrote the story. How long did it take you to write the story?
So the script came sort of quickly. It took me about a month to kind of flesh out a story. But originally there was another director attached. We were just going to produce it and have a director from New York do it. And then unfortunately, a lot of time went by. Just the vision kind of changed a little bit. And I just felt this was something I sort of wanted to take on. So I had a conversation with her about that. She was totally cool with it. She said, hey, it's totally cool. It's director Wings, just kind of, take it on. And it's your aunt's film and all that, your story and all that. So you just go do it. And so then it just, to kind of switch it a little bit, made it more mystical right. and spiritual, and less originally it was kind of Pan's Labyrinth a little bit, very go down this, this world and this whole thing. But it was a little too much, I think, for the story. And so we kept it a little more organic, and it made it feel, so this dream sequence made it feel like it was really happening in real time, and just he's really right. experiencing these things and doing all practical effects, kind of Spielberg style, and just Close Encounters was kind of an inspiration, and just really having it all choreographed to where it was just we're really seeing these things happen. right? And it's not like there's no special effects. It's really the real deal. And that's just how it all happened, you know?
And,
you know,
but and how long from the time you started shooting to the time you finished editing? What was that?
Yeah, it was like 5 or 6 years, man. It was like
wow. 5 years at least.
Yeah.
That's crazy. That's awesome. Yeah, that's what you work.
We had a big chunk where we just kind of like just life got in the way. And then there was no money. We were trying to raise money and just it was like little bits and pieces of money. But we used that money to fly back to Texas and film some things. But then we're like out of money and trying to do little trailers and stuff. And then finally, you know, we got a tax break because of the whole COVID thing, man. Like the whole pandemic. We had a little relief thing that came towards our company, the LLC. And we're like, dude, like we had to like use it for like, you know, for hiring people. And so that's what we did. We just hired everybody. We didn't pay ourselves. We just hired the whole cast and crew and just blew it all on the project. And
that's amazing.
And that's just, it was just like a kind of like just came out of nowhere, man. Just like the film gods were on our side.
That's how filmmakers do it though. They somehow pull it together and it just gets done. It's like kind of yeah. an amazing part of what you do as an artist and craftsman. You know what I mean? It's like yeah. you have to figure out how to find solutions and you did it. Let's talk a little bit about Della. So this is a yeah. new film, a new boxing, a female boxer. Tell me what was the inspiration behind this story and how it all came about.
Yeah, so Rachel Ellner is a friend of mine. She lives here locally in Burbank, and we were neighbors at one point. And she moved away, and she reached out, I want to say like 2 years later, and just said, hey, you know, I'm looking for a director, and like, can you recommend anybody have this like boxing film, female boxing film? I kind of want to get off the ground, and do you know anybody? I'm like, well, I don't know. I'd like to interview for it. You know? So, I'm like, hey, you know, I'm talking to her.
Yeah.
So we had a meeting and we, you know, we kind of connected. And so then from there, like we, right away, just, I met a friend of mine, Carlos, who was friends with some people in South LA boxing. And I was telling him, hey, you know, we're looking for some locations and we want to make this feel organic and real and blah, blah, blah. And so he kind of introduced me to those guys down there in South LA. And I took Rachel and we kind of scouted and then we did a whole photo shoot. So she was kind of, you know, kind of posing. And then we had some other like a boxer, real boxer, female boxer come in and do some poses. And then we formed a pitch deck. And wow. then from that pitch deck, then we started kind of shopping it out and just there you go. We got the funding together and it all just kind of get really quickly, actually. The shooting came really fast, but I had to kind of like restructure the story, the script. So I kind of spent a lot of time kind of rewriting the story because I felt like the sister story like really needed to be fleshed out. And there was the trauma within the physical and mental trauma that they experienced as kids wasn't in the script. And right. so you don't know, it comes out of left field. You don't know like what happens, why the anger? She's a boxer and she has so much anger. And then why are they so estranged and all these things? And so there's all these questions at hand. And so then we shot the flashbacks. That was like months later. We shot the flashbacks in Joshua Tree and actually casted my daughter in it. My daughter, Lucy. She,
that's awesome.
Yeah. So like the boxer, the lead actress, Katie Reese, she's amazing up and coming actress. Rachel Ellner also played in it. Heather Flores, my producing partner. Daniel Mora came back on to do this as well as the coach. And Carlos is also in it as well. And it was really cool just to have all these people come together and be part of this. And they were super excited. I was like boxing as a female boxer and just yeah. the struggles. And then Katie and like my daughter just like look identical, dude. Like it was just crazy.
That's cool.
It was so similar. Yeah, dark brown eyes. Dark brown hair, and it was just amazing. So it just worked out. And like, but again, my daughter's not an actress, and so we you know, through advice from you know my producing partner Heather, like we're like, okay, let's just keep her kind of raw. We'll kind of like we'll let her kind of you know work with Katie, but like not put too much pressure on actually like right. having her you know be so the techniques of acting and all this stuff. Let her be really raw. And Heather, you know, came on to play the mother role when she was a kid. And so they were comfortable. They already knew each other as friends. And so it just was really seamless and smooth. And,
well, now your daughter's got the bug. She's got the bug, the acting bug.
Oh, man. She really blew me away, man. She blew me away. And then we have, you know, just some amazing actors, dude. It was crazy. So she came on board and she just started just kind of improvising. And it was super amazing, man, just to see the process and just kind of like, wow, like she's really, really just falling into it. And like, so the camera guy had to like really like, you know, just bounce around and kind of like follow her a little bit because she was just improvising. Like she was kind of on script, but like going a little off, but like really digging in. And it was really, really, really cool to see, man. And then we had also Barbie Gamboa. Barbie Gamboa is the daughter of Harry Gamboa, famous photographer also. Los Angeles photographer, yeah. And Barbara Carrasco is her mom. Famous female artist here, you know, and they're both Chicanos. And it was really cool to have her be part of the film as well. And she played Rachel as a younger.
That's awesome.
A younger, and she played it so well. And she was like vibing with my daughter, and we went to the desert, man, and just like really shot beautiful like landscape scenes, which is not in that teaser I showed you. You don't see it in the teaser. I haven't cut it into the teaser yet, but it's really beautiful to see that contrast of like just, you know, gym and city, and then the harsh contrast of Shasha Tree, like desert sand. And, It was cool. It was cool to see the
let's play the trailer. Let's play the teaser real quick. Here's the teaser.
Cool.
You got what it takes to be a champion. You got the skills, but more importantly, you got a heart. Like I used to back in the day. It's here and it's here. Tomorrow, I want you to show them what you're made of. Show them who you are. Two, one, two. Number one.
Della, it's Layla again. Please call me back. It's important that I speak with you. Mom's not doing well. Please call me.
Coach him up. Big at the bell.
Bella.
Ma'am, you can't be in here.
I am her sister. What happened out there?
So cool, man. You have like a million-dollar Chicano baby over here.
Oh, man.
When is this going to be released? When's Della going to be released?
Yeah, so we're hoping for January 2025 is the world premiere. Again, you know, we're talking to, like, you know, film festivals like Santa Barbara and other places, but we'll see where it ends up. But we're really excited to really show this one. Everyone's anticipated. We just missed that window this fall to submit to festivals.
But it's so right now when it's not finished, you just can't submit. It's difficult.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. So right now it's being composed. So we're doing the composition. The film is picture locked and we're doing the composition. It's going to be mixed at Village as well. Really, really happy over there. And same way with Lodo. So Lodo did the stereo and 5.1 over there as well. So we're excited to do that again over there. And, you know, so it's we're super happy. Can't wait to get that out in the
world. See it, man. You know, I'm a huge fan of your work, and we've worked together. We will work together again. Where can people find you if they want to find your movies, if they want to ask you to be on their movies, to direct or to be a cinematographer? Where can people find you online?
Yeah, just come to Instagram, R88PROD, and then also Alessandro underscore DOP. And you can find all the links there. And yeah, reach out. No, we're really, we want to tell stories, you know, interesting, you know, Latino stories. And yeah, we want to produce your films and shoot your films and direct them and bring your stuff to life. So yeah, reach out, please.
And you know what? I can testify that Alessandro is a professional. He knows how to work, get it done quickly, get it done well. And man, you're a pleasure to work with, and to know you have an open invitation to come back and feature any of your projects on Wake Up Hollywood. Thanks for being a guest tonight, man.
Yeah, thanks, man. I appreciate it, man. I want to come to your show. And, hey, I see this out right here. I have a look at this guy is right there. Who's that?
Wait, who is that?
That's Jimi Hendrix, bro.
That's my dude.
Look at that photo right there, dude.
Man, he's my dude, man. I've been so crazy about Hendrix lately.
I know, dude, I love that. That's what I'm saying.
I actually just bought a wah-wah pedal of, like it's a Jimi Hendrix style wah-wah pedal today. I'm like, man, I just love him. He's just the bomb. He's the bomb. But yes, awesome. You're going to have to come see my band. We'll have to do some more work together. I'm going to have to have you film an episode of Sight and Sound. We'll talk about that. But on behalf of Alessandro, myself, and Sam, we'll see you guys next week. Check out Alessandro's films online. Peace and love. Take care.
You're listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Corulla and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.